and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 565.
Green Lantern number 13.
I was going to say lucky number 13, but it's greatly in the eye of the beholder. At least it's a quick read.
Well, let's get into it.
All right. So let me just, since I happen to be on that page, let's do the creative team and get that out of the way. So that is... The title is Defense is Down, Jeremy Adams. Penciler is Fernando Passarin, so that's a change. Anchor, Eau Claire Albert. Romulo Fajardo Jr., colorist, Dave Sharp, letterer. Ariel Colon, cover artist, variant cover artist. Gleb Melnikov, Chuma Hill, Salvador LaRocca, and Laura Martin. Artist spotlight variant cover artist is Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Can we have more more names there? Assistant editor Jillian Grant, and Mr. Paul Kaminsky remains the editor. So this is our absolute power tie-in, which it literally says on that variant cover. You got to love it. No subtlety there at all. So Hal's been captured by Amanda Waller on whatever the hell this island of Gamora happens to be. And even though Hal's getting the living hell beat out of him by King Shark, he's happy because all he keeps dwelling on is the fact that Carol came back to rescue him last issue. And Amanda Waller is trying to torture Hal to get the information that Tharos wants about where the source of his ring is. And of course, Hal's ringless at this point. His ring has been taken away. He's being pummeled, but he's just there taking the pain. And he has no desire to talk, as they're using this Tasharan energy fields or whatever is to basically keep him contained. Means nothing to me, but they make a point of mentioning it in the story. So we cut away from Hal to an ever so brief stop with Jessica Cruz, who basically she flies and finds the resistance team that the only part of the resistance team that has not been either captured or defeated yet. So we have Razorback. We have Razor, Salak, 2-6, and sitting still in the corner, even though he's out of range, so they obviously don't see what's really going on with him, is Kyle, who's like going all multicolored as he's talking about how the emotional spectrum is like you control the emotional spectrum, you control the universe. We cut to Sinestro on New Corridor. And which has been decimated now, but by the time he's gotten back, it's decimated. So all he feels is rage about what they've done to New Corrigor and his inability to protect it. And he's determined to exact revenge.
Well, it's like that because the battery exploded.
Yes. The central power battery was destroyed. And now Sinestro is flying off in a rage, looking very atrocious like into the sky. We cut to this Alan Scott tie in with the JSA taking on some of Amanda Waller's goons, and everybody pretty much gets drained of their power, including Alan. His ring gets drained of his power too, but despite that, he still has a connection to the Starheart, so he's able to use that power, potentially draw some. He also draws some power off the robot thing, or that is working with Amanda Waller. So Willpower and Stargirl basically they run, and I guess Green Lantern's able to phase them away, right? Somehow.
Yeah.
So we cut to Chad's probably favorite part of the story, back in Las Vegas, where Well, it had been speculated that once Nathan got left at the altar, that he might turn into this supervillain, which we don't know if he's going to be a supervillain. But now we know, because of the emotional spectrum is so screwed up and he's so sad and depressed. All of a sudden, the engagement ring that was no longer serves any purpose as originally designed. Now all of a sudden becomes a power ring for the sorrow part of the emotional spectrum. Oh, God help us. We have Tharos, who basically is doing his best Parallax impression here, talking about how the universe shouldn't be this way and needs to be set right, how the Owens don't know what they're doing, and basically if I get control of the power, I'll do a much better job setting the universe right and protecting it from what's coming. Even that little panel of him standing upside all the emotional spectrum energy kind of reminds me of that panel, that dual panel we just talked about with Parallax and Zero Hour. But unlike Zero Hour, I don't give a shit about Tharo, so I don't care. Now we go back to Hal, the grand finale of the issue, where he's still being tortured by King Shark. And for some reason, which makes no sense, a headbutt under the jaw of King Shark seems to be not only enough for it to knock King Shark out, but it's also enough for Hal to be able to decide that, hey, this is my opportunity. It's going to hurt like hell, but basically, if I just force my way through these T'Sharan bonds, I'm going to free myself. He does. He actually doesn't seem all that worse for wear. He hears a noise, which is basically he feels the power ring reaching out to him. He sees the power ring engaged like in this containment field and these chambers being loaded onto the ship, which he also happens to see all these other weapons of all these other metahumans and everything else being taken away. And next. Heist. I guess they're tying Ant-Man in next issue. And now Chad has the Tharos origin story that we've all been waiting for.
Written by Mark Guggenheim, artist Matthew Clark, colorist Matt Herms, letterer Dave Sharp, assistant editor Jillian Grant, and editor Paul Kaminsky. The story is called The Patient Blade. As quickly as we can here. Over on Durla, young Tharos grew up under his father, who is said to be a gentleman and a gentle man, and he was a duke. Durla at this point is a monarchy. At one point, he talks about in his reflection about, since he was a gentleman, he never raised a hand to me until one day he did, because for some reason, on a planet with shapeshifters as the dominant species of the planet, even with that evolutionary advantage, nobody figured out a way in all those thousands of years of evolution of how to tell when each other is a shapeshifter. So there's that. So his dad, in quotes, comes home, beats his ass. And it turns out, obviously, not to be his dad, but some thug who had came to kind of let the kid know that his dad's dead in a coup attempt, and he raised you incorrectly. You need to be raised the right way. I'm here to teach you a lesson. The next time I see you, I'm going to gut you. Basically, kind of, you know, grow some balls, kid, kind of a thing. All these years later, he's out on the streets. He comes across this guy again. So he realizes he's not a fighter. He's not strong. So he has to be cunning. So he smashes him with a bottle and runs off. Now in the modern day, we see a guy brought before Tharos and he's talking about how he's now the most powerful leader in the universe and so on and so forth. This guy is brought before him because he tried to run the blockade around 2814. And Tharos basically goes, hey, man, give it up. I know who you are. You're the same thug. So he throws the knife down and says, I recognize it. He ends up dying, of course. He tells the lanterns basically to dispose of the body and everything like that. And the lantern's like, sure have been a lot of prisoners committing suicide lately. He's like, I'll get rid of the body and have that knife cleaned and taken to my quarters because it reminds me of my youth. And that's it.
But the only other caveat being the fact that he pretty much gives this thug the choice. Well, you can kill yourself, or if not, you're going to be tortured in ways you never can imagine, and the pain's going to be so great that The easiest way out for you is to kill yourself, which is why he chooses to kill himself. So, but yeah, so I guess for yep. in a weird way, I guess all it quote unquote humanizes Tharos a tad. But since we have no idea ultimately what Tharos is thinking, why he thinks his vision of the universe is correct, or why he thinks he needs to master the emotional spectrum and control it, because I mean, and we don't need a long laundry list of reasons to think to make assertions that the Guardians weren't using their power correctly, because we've done this for centuries. Literally, people have in the DC universe, let alone us as readers, know that, you know, the case could be made that they either abuse power or they don't understand the power. But it doesn't mean that we have no idea what threat he thinks is coming that they need to. And again, I don't know how much I really care. I suppose on the surface, it makes it better than just trying to want the power to dominate and control everything.
And that's the thing, is when they were soliciting things like the secret origin of Tharos, nobody gave a shit. At least, well, I use the royal nobody.
Right.
You know, then we get the hint that Tharos, in one of the books, that Tharos has something more up his sleeve. He has a specific reason for this that nobody's really understanding, that they don't see the bigger picture, that maybe he has, my goals are beyond your understanding. When we get this, we don't get to see those. And I think that sucks, is because I didn't care. Then you made me curious and then you didn't fulfill the curiosity, which, you know, maybe you will later on, maybe you won't, but we're talking specifically for this backup. You know, I'm back to not really caring. I'm still curious about what his bigger picture is here, because he even hints at it here too, but I'm still not seeing it. This is not something that needs to be drawn out. Just tell me what's on his mind, please. Especially when you dedicate 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages to telling me this backup story.
Well, again, I mean, number one.
And I'm sorry. And in a vignette style issue where we're already jumping back and forth to kind of catch up with characters we haven't seen in a minute, this is the perfect opportunity for you to tell that story.
Yeah, and since we technically get another vignette, we get two Hals and we get two Tharoses. Because we get the in story Tharos story, and then now we get the backup story, which is all Tharos. I've kind of said this before, as we're slowly creeping towards, you know, before you know it, we're going to be if we don't wrap this up in relatively soon, we're going to be a year and a half now of real issues, not in real time, because I think we're probably already there, but in real issues that we're going to have, getting close to a year and a half worth of issues. And this storyline is not over yet. That in a book that's the main story is taking this long, I really don't need backup stories anymore. I'm sorry. I don't care. And I certainly don't want to. It's just, especially since that Guy Gardner story just literally ended, and it didn't even seem like it was a real ending.
Yeah.
I really thought we were getting another part. I almost forgot that we weren't until we, and then I read it. It's like, they kind of just left them falling somewhere, which was weird, because when I first read it, I did think it was the end, and it's like, well, it's probably not the end, because it's kind of like in limbo. It's like, yeah. But I mean, maybe they resolved it in the House of Brainiac thing, but again, not reading it, don't care. I don't know. I think I don't care about the Amanda Waller stuff. I think a lot of the stuff, it's not poorly written from the perspective that Jeremy's a good writer, and he's able to encapsulate, I think, characters and what they're thinking and what they're feeling in a limited amount of pages. So I think in a way vignettes are fine with him. So I think I was not unhappy with how these characters came across. Like, it kind of was a good Hal piece, despite the fact that Hal's, you're not spending much time with Hal or getting a lot of inner workings of Hal's mind going or being expressed in this book more than, let's say, a normal book if he's the focus. But the story is just really taking way too long to come together here. We still don't know what's going on with the emotional spectrum. We don't know what Tharos is really doing, other than the fact that he thinks he's doing, you know, he is parallaxing in his goals, not just seeking power for power's sake. It's like Salak's group never seems to be doing anything. They're on the run, but they're kind of like sitting almost in the same place. Kyle's impotent. He's just sitting in the corner, just having the emotional spectrum watch over him. And we don't. It's just the lack of Carol in this issue was kind of striking, considering they kind of just literally jammed her in out of nowhere again into the story over the last two issues. Well, in her own story, the issue before, and but last issue, and now she's gone because you assume she's captured, but since they're kind of making her like Superwoman and what she's been able to do and Hal's not been able to do, maybe she isn't captured. I don't know. There's still pros in this book, but it's this book is, I think it's kind of really getting back to being bogged down for me. It's like we had a little bit of an uptick, and I still like it more than War Journal, but man, it's. I wish we would get to the main crux of the issue at this point.
Some of those positives you were talking about, having Fernando Pessoa back on art, because Fernando Pessoa was doing some Green Lantern Corps stuff for a while, so he's very familiar with the universe and the characters, so it was good to see his interpretation on the page in most instances. I will say there are a couple of moments that looked off to me, in particular, just in terms of giving one example, not harping on a bunch of them. The first page with Jessica, the bottom panel, her face looks very strange there. But the top of the page where we got a close-up of her face looks great. So there's that, but I don't think that's a new thing for my read of Fernando Pessoa's artwork, because I do remember having comments like that sporadically here and there throughout that Green Lantern Corps run he was on. So that's okay. And of course, like, he does really well on those close-ups, like with Jessica, like I just mentioned, and that splash page with Kyle. And that's, you know, we see Kyle in great detail there. That's really well done as well. Look, the vignettes, I told Mark when this issue came out, this is more like issue 12.5 instead of issue 13. Because it's more of a Hal is captured and he breaks loose. And then as for the rest, it's let's check up on the rest of the crew. And there's that. Now, last time we covered Green Lantern, I did say I was going to try not to judge this because of the story it's attached to, Absolute Power, because none of this is Jeremy Adams' fault. He has to play in the sandbox he's given. So I can only judge what he does within said parameters. And when I do that, it's not too bad. I could sit here and try and criticize, for instance, Nathan being the Sorrow Lantern. But here's the thing. Just because it's the and I had to like initially I had a negative reaction to it, but I had to think about it. I had to read this once or twice again. This may be the first time we're seeing the Sorrow Lanterns. That doesn't mean Nathan is the first Sorrow Lantern, because a guy who got left at the altar on Earth doesn't really seem like the greatest candidate to be our first Sorrow Lantern ever. But then I realized it doesn't mean he's our first Sorrow Lantern ever. He's just the first one we're seeing. Or if he is, there's also a possibility that because of his proximity to Earth, and Earth being, you know, a place that generates a lot of lanterns, and or his proximity to the lanterns in general, in terms of he is in Carol and Hal's orbit, that whatever is in charge of the Sorrow Spectrum at this point maybe specifically targeted him. We don't know. So because there's so much we don't know, then I am forced to wait till we see more. I do like the design. I think it's really cool. The tattered robes, the crying and everything, the wilted flower, the fact that he wilts things that he's touching and things like that. That's interesting too. It's very easy to be like, oh, his power is sad boy. But, you know, when you know, Mark and I were talking about it too, it's just like when we first read the issue, it's just you're encompassing, when you say sorrow, you're not just encompassing, oh, I'm a romantic loss or whatever, I'm sad. It can be probably depression. It could probably be grief. It could, like, that's a big part of the emotional spectrum that we haven't touched yet. And it's often one people bring brought up when the emotional spectrum was at its height, when we were talking about, okay, let's like throw shots in the dark, like colors that haven't been touched. What emotion would you associate with them? The first one off of a lot of people's list was some sort of sadness or something, because it wasn't really covered by the emotional spectrum. So cool to see that. Hey, Alan's in action, and we don't have to circle back and say, hey, as a reminder, he's gay. I'm glad that we see him in action. He's doing his thing. He's with his family. Great representation of him. We don't have to keep making every story about it. Fantastic. I don't care if he is or if he isn't, but he's a hero. Let's see him hero. Bam. We got it. Fantastic. I'm here for it. And the Sinestro stuff I'll talk about later, because I've been rambling for a minute and I want Mark to touch on some of that stuff too.
Well, it makes sense that you're not going to get any dwelling on Alan's sexuality here. Number one, because Jeremy's writing it. So this is not going to be, if he's going to use Alan Scott, or whether he wants to, or he's quote unquote told to, in all likelihood, he's not going to go out of his way to be jumping into stuff like that, as opposed to Sheridan and other people who that's how they would want to write him anyway, as opposed to just picture him as a Green Lantern. So, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I to be perfectly blunt, him being in the book makes no sense, really. There's no real relevance to
yet.
It's the one that stands out like a sore thumb, because it's not like we've been following Alan Scott in this book, as opposed to, yes, we followed 2-6 and that group, and yes, we've seen Tharos. We don't care, but we've seen Tharos. It's like, okay, the Alan Scott thing seems really out of place for now. But you're correct. It's for now. Let's see what kind of payoff, you know, if there is a substantial payoff in this. For what the issue was, it was okay. This is not my least favorite issue of the book. So it's, and like I said, I think he handles the characterizations well. It's just like I mentioned, it seems the plot is really moving ahead slowly. And for a story that's been going on already in real time for like a year and a half, that's not a good thing. It's like, we need to pick up the pace. We need to get more. We've gotten a few answers along the way to different things. We've had to wait a long time for almost every answer we get, and we still have tons of answers that we haven't gotten. And you're rattling that Derlin cage too much, considering the last time we had a long story with Derlin's, it kind of like sucked the life right out of Venditti's run almost to start the book, his book. So
yeah, I want to talk a bit about the Sinestro thing, but it's going to cause a rant. So. A brief one, but a rant nonetheless. So, just circling back, to some other things, I do agree in terms of some of the pacing, in terms of them drawing this out. Again, that's why, part of why I said this is 12.5 instead of 13, because there's not a whole lot of progression here. We're just sort of resetting the chess pieces, so we know everything that's on the board now that we're in this new story arc with Absolute Power. That he's being asked to work in. So, okay. But having every time we see Kyle, except that one time where we saw a brief explosion of power, which did very interesting things, him just kind of holding his knees in the corner going, I'm not okay, I'm not okay, I'm not okay. Like,
yeah, okay. It's old.
Yeah. That's a specific plot point I wish would pick up a little faster, because it's not making our boy look good. Now, that could just be to, you know, belie the severity, or rather enhance the severity to the reader of what's happening to him, the fact that he can't deal with it and can't deal with it this long. But still, there's that.
And it would make more sense if he was still, or if he still had been the White Lantern. But he's not. So him having a unique connection to the spectrum is plausible, but mm-hmm. but maybe having it to this extreme, when it's not like he's been actively tapping into all these aspects of the, it's been a long time since he's been tapping into the full emotional spectrum. So that's another thing. But then again, it's hard for us to judge, because we don't know what's going on with the spectrum.
Yeah. I'm also curious about the last page where everything's getting loaded up into that ship, which doesn't look like it's big enough to hold everything that's currently going up its ramp. But some of these cases being carried out, those are Captain Boomerang's boomerangs. That's Mr. Freeze's gun, it looks like, and tank and fuel tanks, I think. That's Harley's hammer. Yep. Is that Kite Man's kite?
It might be.
I don't know about the other three things. The one that looks like a bunch of Harry Potter wands, the helmet, and then that cube looking thingy. I don't know what those are. But them being boxed up, I don't know. It looks like Hal's ring is in one of the said boxes. So them boxing up weapons makes sense, but is Harley Quinn's hammer really a weapon? Is Kite Man's kite like full of gadgets that I don't know about? Like, I don't know. I don't know if we need to put Kite Man's kite under quarantine.
Yeah, unless we're gonna find out that there's some ties to how the powers are getting drained that are related to aspects of their uniform or their weapons and things, which doesn't make a lot of sense because it seems like, though we don't know this, that if Hal could get to his ring, he would be fine. But that's different because as long as Hal's ring has power, he should be fine if he can get to his ring. So I don't know, but it's thank you, DC editorial.
And speaking of DC editorial, thank you so much for that opening.
I've been good at that lately.
The Sinestro page. Okay. Clarification before we get started. None of this is on Jeremy Adams. I am speaking about DC editorial because two things that Jeremy Adams does not do, or the writers do not do, is write solicits and are in charge of the narrative boxes within the comics. Like this one on the Sinestro page, it says, to see more of what Sinestro has been up to, catch Sinister Stuns number 6 and Kneel Before Zod number 7. By the way, the solicit for Sinister Stuns number 6 reads, Sinson's origin revealed in the final issue. The truth of Sinson's origin is at last revealed. No, it's not. I've read Sinister Stuns number 6. You want to know what happens? He and Lor Zod are on the surface of New Khorogar alongside of Sinestro as he's redirecting people to help clean up the aftermath of New Khorogar. Sinson pulls him aside and attacks him and says, "You are my father. I think you're my father." And the entire conversation, which I will say, I think is a very fantastically written issue in terms of their interpretation of Sinestro's cadence, the way he would approach that situation, so on. I think it's a great characterization of Sinestro in that issue. I will give it that credit. But what he's doing when he fires off some rounds at Sinestro is they're essentially dart-type rounds meant to take some of Sinestro's blood so that he can figure out via a blood test whether or not Sinestro is or is not his son. And Sinestro essentially says, it doesn't matter whether I am or I'm not, because you're already the man you're going to be. You have gone through all of these things and all that. It doesn't matter who your father is. You are a product of your experience, and knowing this is not going to change anything. That's all we find out. His origin is not revealed. We don't know who his father is. Unless they're trying to be cheeky with it and be like, oh, his origin's revealed because Sinestro said that he's the person he was throughout this journey, that he's become the man who he's going to be. And this story we've been reading this whole time is his origin. Okay, if they're being cheeky with it, whatever, not that big of a deal. Kneel Before Zod number 7 has absolutely nothing to do with Sinestro whatsoever, other than the fact that when Zod gets back on his ship at the end and resolution of the current storyline or plot or whatever, even if the storyline's still ongoing, this is just the next piece. Sinestro is literally just floating outside of Zod's ship, looking at Zod with a, you know, his arms crossed and his feet flat kind of a manner that Sinestro does in his Red Lantern costume. Because the only thing that you need to know from either of these two mentioned issues is not anything involving Sinson, not anything from the Zod issue. You just need to know that Sinestro was on New Corridor, which you got here. And the only thing I could possibly fathom as part of interesting information moving forward into Sinestro's remainder of this story from Sinister Sons number 6 is one of the lines Sinestro says is a piece of evidence was unearthed in the debris and it may help me deliver righteous vengeance to whoever was responsible for destroying my central power battery. That is it. And I wonder, the next time we see Sinestro, if he reveals anything about what happened to his power battery, do you think narratively we're already, based on what he's saying and the context he provides in the scene that we get that information, that we're already going to be told that later on, that he found it on New Corrigar? So therefore, nothing about Sinister Sons number 6, and absolutely nothing about Neil Before Zod number 7 have anything to do with what's happening on the two pages of Sinestro we get in this issue. It's possible Neil Before Zod number 8 might have something, because 7 ends with one page with zero narrative information whatsoever from Sinestro, just a picture of him floating outside of Zod's ship. Because it ends with Sinestro, it's probable that issue 8's going to have a lot to do with Sinestro, but Sinister Sons number 6 and Neil Before Zod 7? Nothing to do with it whatsoever.
DC editorial.
I get it when, like, trying to, you know, tie things together, you know, little pieces of crumbs of information are here, here, and here. Let's try and build our brand. Let's try and get people to spend some more money. But it feels like cheating to allude that there's critical information and other issues when there's not. There's just straight up not. Sinister Sun 6, based on everything I said, you could, in theory, make a small case for. Neil Before Zod 7, maybe 8 later on, but 7? No. Absolutely not. Absolutely nothing is revealed in that issue. Absolutely nothing matters whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't, it's really hard to understand why they, we kind of know why they do what they do, but it's hard to just kind of like accept it and just say, oh yeah, it's like, it's part of the game. You know, there's nothing nothing sneaky here or nothing underhanded here. It's like, yeah, it's like, come on.
Yeah. Good. Sorry, I posted basically the same rant over on the Blog of Oa Facebook page. And Jim Ford tried to play devil's advocate, and I completely see his point. But he said this narrative box says to see more of what Sinestro has been up to. Technically, they fulfilled that promise because Sinestro is in both issues and we see what he's been up to. But that's not why you put a narrative box there. You do it to try and sell those issues.
Yeah, that is true. And it would make sense why they would try to push people towards probably both of those, because neither one of those are selling. So from a business perspective, it makes sense, because obviously we talked about how Sinister Sons were just sold, that book just sold horribly. And I think Neil Before Zod is selling pretty crappy too, based on what I remember reading somewhere. So the reality is it makes sense why they would try to do that false little pumping life into it, or try to pump some life into it for that reason, but it still doesn't make it right.
One of the commenters, Matt Thompson, on that thread said, Bleeding Cool has been saying for a while that Neil Before Zod is the precursor to the next year's Superman event, and in Sinestro, maybe we'll have a Supes GL punch-up next year. So, in terms of that series meaning anything, you know, first of all, it's relying on reporting from Bleeding Cool, which has lost my respect over the past several years, especially after a direct interaction with Rich Johnston. So I really don't trust Bleeding Cool as far as I can throw him. And I'm not a very strong person. So
Neil Before Zod number 5 was number 153. on the list. We haven't, because we still haven't gotten the sales for June out yet. But that book has not been a big seller overall. Even though I think it did climb. It was unranked. It went from unranked all the way up to 153. So depending on number six sells, maybe it's moving in the right direction. But up to that point, obviously, it had been selling horribly.
But that's all I got. That's all I got for this issue. I was a little disappointed at it being a bunch of vignettes, but for being a bunch of vignettes and essentially being a 0.5 issue, I liked it.
Yeah, I didn't hate it. It could have been a little better. If the story had been moving on a bit faster, a bit smoother, and not these hitting so many bumps in the road, I think I would appreciate this more. But beggars can't be choosers right now, and we ain't got a lot to choose from.
All right. Well, since we're done with that, what's next on the Rocket Docket?
Let's do a few things before we go over to you for Chad's big moment in the sun here. 30 plus years in the making. So let's do a few things first. I threw out those sales numbers just because it was convenient, because I had that thing open by luck of the draw, because I was looking for to see if the June ones had opened. One thing I wanted to mention, because we never got a chance to talk about this, because we reviewed the books before the last issue, before the sales came out. So I just want to make it sound like we're sweeping it under the rug, just because it actually is a little more positive, that the last issue of Alan Scott actually moved all the way up to 116.
That's good.
Yeah. So it actually, I don't quite understand why it finished stronger, unless some people had just said, well, this is the last issue and I didn't buy the last couple. Let me just at least see where it ends as a status quo thing. But to be fair, yeah, it's still not great, but it moved up like from, I think, like the 160s or something into the 116 spot. So I did want to mention that, to be fair. So ever so briefly, what has Mark seen? I saw Despicable Me. And I saw Long Legs. Despicable Me was fine. I mean, I fell asleep on it, which had nothing to do with the movie. It's because I was tired. It was a long day. But Long Legs was interesting. It was an interesting horror movie. It's hard to describe. I mean, but it's obviously it's doing quite well, which is why they moved it from a small theater to a big theater, which was surprising. I still wish Regal would tell you when they do that. That's one of the major flaws. You never know. If I didn't happen to check to see if people were sitting near us, I would never have known they moved us to a big theater. But that said, not much to say. I got Twisters this week. And then, of course, next week, as we're recording this, the big one, Deadpool and Wolverine, which at some point we will do an episode on. And last but not least, related to Deadpool and Wolverine slightly, despite what we heard relatively recently to the contrary, it is interesting that today all the stories, as we're recording, all the stories are going out, and we probably will know more. This might be, who knows, this might be confirmed by the weekend once we get to Comic-Con stuff, that now all of a sudden the Russo brothers might actually be directing the next two Avengers movies, but they pretty much had been ruled out for directing any. But since that whole, the next Avengers movie, supposedly not only didn't they have a director, but that Waldron, who was assigned to it, has been moved to another movie. So they don't technically, I think, have a writer or have a director for Avengers 5, whatever it's going to be yet. But that's the rumors. The big rumor of the day is that I guess it's official that they're talking to Disney, to Marvel about it, which probably means there's a pretty decent chance it's going to pay off, because even though they don't say they're in final negotiations, the fact that they have a good relationship with Feige and everybody, the fact that they're actually talking seriously about it now, it would be probably surprising if they didn't do at least one of the two, if not both.
I learned about that via a tweet that was getting a lot of traction, because someone had retweeted that news and said, okay, now DC, you take their cue and do the right thing and bring him back, and posted a picture of Zack Snyder.
Oh, God. People need to get a life. Oh, my God. Hey, we know there's flaws in Infinity War and Endgame, and especially because of their inability to figure out what to do with omnipotent heroes, which doesn't give you a lot of hope for doing something like Secret Wars, that a lot of the characters you'd like to see have moments that, like, they're going to be on the back burner. But the reality is, yes, if Zack Snyder's movies were better, they would have done, the fans would have liked them more, they would have made more money, and DCWB wouldn't have shown them the door. They weren't that good. That's the reality. And I like some of Zack Snyder's stuff, but his DC stuff wasn't that fantastic. There are some things in Man of Steel that were just so horribly off that just sank that movie. BVS, bloated, that tends to be his thing, bloat. So the reality is that there's absolutely no comparison. You know, the Russos delivered two of the biggest movies of all time. Zack Snyder delivered some of the bigger disappointments. I mean, especially BVS, that movie, that should have been a $1 billion movie easy, and it wasn't. So, but yeah, that's that. I happened to notice that today, and I thought it was funny because it was only like about a week or so ago when it was almost declared definitively that the Russos wouldn't be addressing. Because supposedly, this is the interesting part, though. Supposedly, the story that I had read previously was they had reached out to Marvel to inquire about it, and they kind of had been rebuffed. So it's kind of interesting if they are actually talking now, you probably would say, well, it's Marvel reaching out to them, which if that's the case, it's more of an indictment again on the current state of where the MCU is, that they would go, well, we might as well, maybe we should go back to these guys. The devil you know, versus the devil you don't, if nothing else.
Yeah.
All right, Chad, it's you.
All right. I mentioned it in our 0 hour coverage, but 0 hour coverage was for 0 hours. But I only wanted to say enough to just alert people as timely as possible, and said we would elaborate it on a later episode. This is that episode. On July 5th, news started breaking that McFarland was going to do a line of their DC multiverse, a wave featuring a bunch of characters, like Agent Liberty, I think it was. There's also a Clock King figure, lots of characters that have never really had a nice detailed action figure, including Ragman. So yeah, I saw some images and, you know, took to the internet to resurrect the Ragman blog over at thesuitofsouls.blogspot.com, which I only mentioned because, look, there's no advertising over there, so you can go read it if you want. I took the time to write something and put it together, so go ahead. I'm going to post another something at some point this week as we record this, so by the time this episode goes up, there should be a second post about this over there. But those went live for pre-order on the 12th. My original, you know, haphazard, I'm going to go absolutely apeshit plan was to buy 6 of them. but that, which is a whole case, by the way, which McFarland does offer. It's for $197.94 before taxes and shipping. And it guarantees to come with one of the chase figures if there's a chase figure, which there is for this one, which we'll get into in a little bit. But instead I opted to go for 3, one for out of box, one for inbox, and another for, just in case, or maybe I do like a giveaway on the Ragman blog if I, you know, get it going more consistently in the next few years, or maybe I want to take it to cons. And if I run into Ragman creators, I can just have like a nice kind of jam piece of just a bunch of signatures of Ragman creators and stuff like that, since that's a small group. I don't know, just a something else type figure. I didn't do it so I could get the chase, because frankly, I'm not too intrigued by the chase or excited about it. To me, people who get excited about chases when they aren't particularly excited for the actual figure itself are just trying to be like, ooh, look at me, I'm cool, I have a chase. That's the way I feel about Funko collectors who go after a chase just because, instead of them having any interest in the actual figure that's in the box. They do it for the clout and for the retail sale afterwards on the aftermarket. I think that's kind of bullshit, but whatever. Can't blame people for trying to hunt down a profit, I suppose. But anyways, it went live and I pre-ordered it. It is one of their McFarlane Collector Edition figures, so the kind of wider box. If you guys know about the Alan Scott figure, which was labeled the Day of Vengeance figure, that's the collector's edition I'm referring to. You have your figure, you have any accessories, and you have the collector's card that comes with all McFarlane figures in one form or another. But for some reason, the collector's edition figures have a stand that instead of house, instead of being designed to hold the figure, is for some reason designed to hold the trading card, which has never made sense to me and seems like a waste of plastic, but whatever. The Ragman figure is look, I know I'm biased. I know I am. I'm specifically taking time out of a Green Lantern podcast to talk about a Ragman figure. I get it. But this is a damn good figure for a character that has never, ever had one iota of merchandise of this caliber since its creation in 1976. There have been only two Ragman-related quote-unquote figures ever in existence, and they're basically they're you guys out there, you know HeroClix? You know how tiny those are? How poorly rendered some of those can be, including if not sculpt, paint job. There's been two Ragman HeroClix figures. That's it. No t-shirts, no mugs, pencils. There's never been a piece of Ragman merchandise officially from DC Comics or anybody who holds the DC Comics license aside from those two HeroClix tokens. For them to get it this damn right for this, you know, for the sake of argument, I'm going to call it the first Ragman merchandise ever. This is damn good, because my problem with this Alan Scott figure, and I'm looking at it right now, it's on the shelf right behind my computer screen as we talk. It is asinine to me that Alan is behind the cardboard on the left-hand side of the box. You cannot see an entire, well, it's Alan's right-hand side, but looking at the figure, it's the left-hand side. You can't see from his shoulder on an entire portion of the figure, yet the damn display stand with the stupid trading card is in full view of that window. That has been swapped. They recognize their mistake for this McFarland Collector Edition Ragman figure, as well as some of their other Collector's Edition figures. And the card and the stand are on the left, partly obscured behind the cardboard, and Ragman the figure is on full display. He is wearing the suit of souls. There is patchwork painted onto the figure. Lots of articulation, which is great for a figure that is supposed to be our character that's supposed to be very lithe, very agile, very acrobatic. His accessories, they snap around his wrists, not his hand, which is cool. And they are actually patchwork. They are, it's translucent patchwork, essentially, in a spiral shape, which is meant to mimic when in comics you see like Ragman consuming somebody's soul and bringing it into his suit of souls. The patches sort of fly off of him and spiral around somebody. So I could not think of a better accessory than to have a spiral of patchwork to the best of your ability as an accessory for a figure. His hood and cloak is fabric. It's tattered and it's perfect, as well as the little ties that come off of it around the neck are very, very long, longer than you would think would need to be for something tied around a figure's neck. But that's perfect because in the post-crisis version of Ragman, Pat Broderick, if you look at like issue one of the Pat Broderick Ragman series in the 90s, Keith Giffen did the writing and all that. Pat Broderick, in addition to having the cape kind of flowing around, the ties around the cloak were kind of like, you know, just really super long and kind of dangling them off of him. This is, to me, without a doubt, the 1990s Pat Broderick interpretation of Ragman come to life in action figure form. Now, McFarlane's website says Shadow Pact. It's Ragman, you know, and in parentheses Shadow Pact, and the trading card artwork, as well as the artwork that's on the back of the box, are from the 2010 Suit of Souls one shot that came out that year. So it's kind of all over the place there. But I got three of them, and they pre-orders ship in August, and I can't wait, man. This is crazy. I I know when I started the Action Comics Weekly podcast, which obviously hasn't had an episode in forever. We don't have to talk about failed projects, but it was so wild to me that I did the Ragman blog, and that was kind of big simultaneously at the time. In terms of it releasing more frequently, suddenly Ragman shows up on a season of Arrow, and at the same time, of all fucking characters, Wild Dog showed up on Arrow, who was a part of Action Comics Weekly. So two of my fan little hobby projects on the side, focusing on specific characters, suddenly started getting representation in multimedia for those two characters. Not that I'm a big Wild Dog fan, but it's doubly wild that Ragman being a popular character on Arrow for just a little bit, and all the merchandise that came out of Arrow that we still never got a Ragman figure or even like a Ragman Funko. Cause God, how many Arrow themed Funkos did we get? This is crazy. I'm gonna let you talk for a second. Cause you are also, you're a toy guy. So in terms of articulation, production, all that stuff, you're very familiar with that. So what do you think of this figure? All of my, you know, bloviating aside.
Did you say something, Chad? I went to take a leak. I'm sorry. It is a nice looking figure. You're obviously your deal with the devil has really paid off lately. So you may regret that down the road, but for the brief period of time you're alive, at least you're going to have those figures to look at. Like, thank you, Prince of Darkness. The variant's interesting too. It, like you said, it's hard to really understand. But not necessarily understand, but it's hard to say, oh, yeah, I know exactly where that variant's from or why they did that variant. But
which I do know now. But we'll
now,
talk
now you do. Now you do know.
Yeah, I do know now. That's what the second post about this figure is going to be about. I know what the variant is.
I was going to say, well, most people know, but most people won't know the Ragman. But well, the majority of people who are at least casually familiar with Ragman, you think will know that variant, or is it really
not by looking at it? But once I tell you, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's nice, even without knowing where it's from. It's a nice looking figure, and at least it's a variant of the same. I mean, it technically. The Spectre one's still the same character too. It's not entirely because the variant is Hal, which I looked at before as we were recording. I did my painful trip onto eBay to see how much people are charging for that variant, and it's ridiculous. It's like over $200 now. And like you were talking about, you know, no one gives a shit about Hal as the Spectre. It's just they just want to make money on the variant. As opposed to me, who would love to have that figure because I like it. But yeah, I'm surprised. Well, I did notice the 6-pack was available. I'm kind of surprised in a way you didn't get the 6-pack.
No, I didn't do it. I was actually going to pre-order it off Big Bad Toy Store, but even as of right now, we're recording on the 17th. It's not on Big Bad Toy Store at all. Not even up for pre-order. Not even up like an active page just holding it until they have stock, like nothing. It's not on there. That so I had to order it. From yeah.
Was it on Entertainment Earth?
I didn't check.
I'm going to check. Yeah. That's if it's something that's going to be readily available and not a site exclusive that's kind of weird. That is kind of weird how it's not showing up there. So that is quite interesting, but you never. Yeah, I don't think, let's see, I don't think it's on Entertainment Earth either. Of course, trying to type when we record is hard because my friggin' microphone's right in front of the keyboard.
You're good. So I'll start talking about the variant. Yeah, it's not on Entertainment Earth. Okay. So I was clicking around, and obviously, so when you open up the webpage on McFarlandToyStore.com specifically for the figure, which as of right now is sold out. There are two tabs on their website for the figure. One is a video, which is basically a link to their YouTube post showing how the figure looks in terms of out of box, and it's just basically spinning around or whatever. And that's the default tab that's selected. You have to click the other tab that says description that gives a nice little summary about the character. It says like Ragman as featured in Shadow Pact, which is wrong, by the way, because they're saying this is Ragman as featured in Shadow Pact as per this this thing here. But if you read the actual description, which says war veteran Roy Regan is the only survivor of his unit. His buddies died and were sucked into the suit of souls they found in an ancient desert vault. They stayed inside Regan's head when he returned to Gotham City, followed by an army of demons seeking to claim the rags that had bonded with him. Regan was now inextricably linked to a mantle of hell, demonic armor that absorbs souls to generate power. And that's only half of the description. But the reason I emphasize those words is because that is not the synopsis of Ragman as I prefer him in terms of post-crisis Ragman suit of souls concept and everything. That is the more recent version of Ragman that was getting a mini series a couple of years back. The kind of reintroduction of Ragman that looked more like a kind of mummy-esque type character instead of what we're used to with the suit of souls and the cloak. That is the version that the variant is. The thing is, this is the Ragman miniseries, by the way, was Ray Fox and Naki Miranda. When it was artistically rendered, it was at its darkest, kind of like a grayish green type suit and everything like that. But it at its lightest, it looked like kind of tannish, tannish style mummy rags. But the interpretation in there was not that the suit was like, you know, connected to like the Golem of Prague in terms of it being like raised by Jewish. Is it priest? What's the word for a Jewish
rabbi?
Rabbis.
No, rabbi. Well, rabbi is a teacher, but I think it's probably the same. It's probably the same thing.
Yeah, raised by rabbis, and it's basically a different incarnation of the. It's a protector of the Jewish people. No, in this case, it was a suit from hell, and is like a It's literally here. It says in the description, demonic armor, a mantle. So that's where its power was passed down from. That interpretation, Mark, I just sent you a picture. I did a search to find like the because I know how it looked in the Ragman series by Ray Fox and Inaki Miranda. I know how it looked there. I wanted to see what the original design was, which I think might be in the back of this trade. I'm not sure, but I found a tweet from Inaki Miranda showing that back when the series was being announced. And if you match the design of this up with the variant, it's the same thing. It in terms of these little glowy pieces that are two pieces on one side of the hip, two pieces on the other, a few up and down the arm, and a kind of almost lightning bolt type insignia on the chest. That is this version of Ragman that we see in the variant. So this is the Ray Fox and Aki Miranda more modern day interpretation of Ragman. The thing is, it was never pitch black. The orangish kind of glow parts are the same. It was never pitch black. And the character was wrapped in rags. And this variant figure, as well as obviously the real figure, have no texture to show any sort of wrap whatsoever on the figure. And of course, the biggest thing is this modern interpretation of Ragman that I'm referring to never had a cloak and cape. So that's why I couldn't figure out what the hell this was. Because it's one, black. Two, there's no texture showing that it's the straps of fabric that are the more mummy-esque interpretation. And three, the character never had the cloak. But that's what this variant figure is supposed to be. It's a very poorly rendered one, which is why I don't care to get it. But that's what it's supposed to be.
At least that makes sense. And yeah. we kind of know, unfortunately, that sometimes McFarlane's figures are good. And they make sense, and they're a good representation. And other times, it's like the first Walmart exclusive Parallax, which is a steaming pile compared to. The Zero Hour one is much better. The Amazon exclusive is much better, but neither one you'd write home about compared to the Pop Funko to the Parallax Funko. I mean, that's how can you get so much detail in a Funko and then butcher it in such a larger figure?
I would really like to. I know we talked about this kind of in terms of ideas. I would like to do a top five McFarland episode, McFarland figure, like including like the page punchers, the superpowers figures. Like since McFarland has had the license these last several years, what are our favorite McFarland figures? Obviously, for us, it's going to be very Lantern heavy, but I wouldn't mind throwing in a couple oddballs here in our top fives.
Yeah, we definitely can do that.
Yeah, I still need that Necron mega figure. And that Sinestro, the Sinestro Core War Collector's Edition one. I still don't have those.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I did just get the Green Lantern Batman, though. That was cool.
Kind of hard to butcher that one.
True. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to August when this Ragman figure comes in. Because I've recently figured out what the variant is, I'm going to obviously come up with a more detailed slash in-depth post about what it is and what's wrong with it and stuff like that. It's just so odd to me that as right as they got the original Ragman, that the variant is so wrong. But I get it, like a variant just being a different paint job, it's kind of the thing now, unless you're going to spend a bunch of money on production. So them texturing the figure with the wrapped rags and stuff like that for the variant, and then changing the paint job and getting the cloak out of there instead and doing all that and trying to make it look more ethereal, kind of like those sketches I sent your way.
Yeah.
Which will be up on that post I'm talking about for you listeners at home so you can see what I'm talking about. That's probably too much capital to sink into it, you know?
Yeah, I do think that's a valid point too. Something you have to be aware of.
Yep, but they'll ship in August at some point, so we'll see them eventually. All right, thank you for letting me vent happily. So
yeah, that is true. It's much better to have a happy vent than blown a gasket.
All right, what else do we want to talk about?
I don't think we have anything.
Okay. Well, if people want to reach out to us, what do they do?
LanternCast.com, LanternCast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GeoCast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, whichever platform you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.